Miss Keane came over to the house yesterday. I'd picked Jack up from school, was making a bit of dinner, and she just came in through the back door. She'd a man with her.
Tom was watching her. Had he tensed? Did he know what was coming?
He said he was a teacher, but he's not from our school. They went upstairs to talk to Mother, and when they came down, Miss Keane said I was to go back to school, that I shouldn't be missing out on my education. She said the man would bring Jack home from school every day, stay with Mother until I get home.
What about the money? Tom asked.
Miss Keane said that I can work on weekends, that she won't stop the money.
She didn't need to tell Tom that this made no sense, that it conflicted with everything they knew of Domenica Keane, who made her work for every penny until her hands were raw and her body shook from tiredness and hunger.
I don't think the money is going to come from Miss Keane, Tom.
The fear rose up in her again then, and she bit down on it hard before it could choke her. Blood again in her mouth. She shook her thumb out and watched the swift rivulet run. Tom's hands were gripping the chains of the swing, hard, his knuckles white from the pressure. His eyes were locked on Maud, but his thoughts were far away, and his face was haunted. She wanted to stop the conversation there, go to him, comfort him.
He said his name was Mr. Schiller, Simon Schiller. You never told me who it was, Tom, and I promised I would never, never talk about it again. But I have to ask you now.
You have to stop him.
Tom's voice came out in a rasping whisper. He coughed, wiped his mouth.
Tell your mother. If you tell her, she won't let him into the house.
Maud put her face in her hands, leaning her elbows against her knees. She felt her grief rise and pressed her palms so hard to her eyes that they hurt. Crying wouldn't stop Simon Schiller. Crying wouldn't change what her mother had become.
She already knows.
They sat in silence for a long moment until Tom stood abruptly and walked away, stopping at the edge of the playground to vomit.
Sorry,
he said.
I'm sorry.
Maud wanted to tell him it didn't matter, that he had nothing to say sorry for, but she couldn't find the words.
Mother says I have to go to school on Monday.
Tom swallowed.
I'll tell the police, he said. We'll go to the social workers.
Maud was shaking her head.
They won't believe you. They didn't believe you when you tried to tell them before, did they? What am I going to do, Tom?
You'll have to run away. I'll help.
I can't run away with Jack. He's only 5. How would I take care of him? How would I feed him, get him to school? No one would believe I'm old enough to be his mother. They'd have us back here in less than a week.
What makes you think your mother knows?
Maud looked away. She shook her head. Valeria was so much worse. There were long red furrows in her skin from the scratching. There'd been blood in her vomit the other night, blood in her urine, and she was confused a lot of the time. But after Keane and Schiller had left, Maud had gone upstairs and seen the extra vodka bottles, the roll of pound notes on the bedside table.
I need to talk to Hannah, she said.
Tom looked confused.
I need her to get something for me.
What? Maud took a deep breath, clenched her fists.
As long as my mother is alive, there's no way out for me and Jack. They'll never take us away from her. And I can't run away and keep Jack safe. He needs a family. He needs a normal family. Parents who feed him every day and bring him to school and keep him safe.
My mother's dying.
Do you know there's blood in her pee every day? Her skin is yellow. Sometimes she doesn't even know where she is. She's going to die, Tom. But not fast enough to save Jack.
Tom was staring at her now, understanding as well as horror and pity growing in his eyes.
Not fast enough unless I do something,
Maud said quietly. Tom didn't say anything, breathing quickly as if he had just run up a hill.
So,
she took a deep breath.
I need to talk to Hannah. I need her help.
Knowing as she spoke what she was asking of him, how terrified he was for his sister. He'd confided his worries to Maud, that Hannah was in over her head with someone older. He was a drug dealer, and maybe he'd started Hannah on some of what he sold. She knew what she was asking of him, to be complicit in this thing, to make his sister complicit in it.
He might end up in a group home.
Tom's voice was hoarse.
Or with shitty foster parents.
It had happened to him and Hannah more than once. They had parents, but their mother had bipolar disorder, and every time she'd had to be hospitalized, they'd been taken into care. Their father said he couldn't cope.
They weren't all bad,
Maud said. He paused for a long moment, then bent down to pick up his backpack, slung it over his shoulder.
Come on, he said. She'll be at the flat.
She'd followed him down the street, her eyes on his back, terrified and grateful. And as they walked, her dread and her determination had grown. She would do whatever it took to save Jack. Now, in the interview room, Maud said,
Hannah didn't say anything else?
Tom shook his head, looked down at the statement.
She says she assumed you bought it from Rick to use it yourself, and your mother got hold of it somehow, but she never asked questions before or after.
They both knew that wasn't true. Hannah had shown her what to do, given her the syringe and shown her how to cook it up, how to inject. She hadn't been expert, not then at any rate, but she'd observed the process more than once, and that had been enough.
Right, said Maud slowly. You think she's trying to make a deal?
I'm sure of it. She's not eligible for early release until she's served 2 years, but they have broad discretion on temporary release. They could release her early and call it temporary release until the end of her sentence. I know that Hannah tried to do deals before, tried to get out any way she could, but it wasn't happening. She had nothing to bargain with.
Tom tapped the file folder again.
This statement. This was her bait. What else could it be?
Maud nodded.
I'm sorry, Maud. But I can't be your lawyer. I can refer you. Get you the very best counsel.
You can't represent me because you're already Hannah's lawyer, and you think there's a conflict.
There's obviously a conflict. You'll have to pull her apart in your defense, and I'm so sorry, Maud. But I have to do what I can to protect her. I'm not saying I'll push her testimony forward, but Christ. What the hell am I supposed to do?
Maud was quiet for a long time. When she spoke, her voice was husky, from tiredness or emotion or both.
They must have asked you, too.
What?
They must have asked what you knew. We were best friends. Anna was your sister.
They asked me. I told them I didn't know anything.
Okay.
She should get another lawyer. A lawyer who would get her bail so she could find out what the hell had happened to Jack. A lawyer who could and would tear Hannah Collins apart on the stand so she could be cleared of these charges and get back to her life, wherever that would be.
I want you,
she said. He said nothing, just looked at her across the battered old table.
I want you to be my lawyer, and I want you to be Hannah's lawyer.
Maud, I don't think you understand. I can't represent both of you. The only way I could do that would be if you didn't dispute Hannah's evidence, if you accepted it. I can't represent two clients whose interests conflict in this way.
I understand better than you do, Tom. Hannah's not my enemy. She wasn't then, and she isn't now.
Maud felt a heavy certainty settle into place.
Hannah did what she could to help me save Jack. Now it's my turn.
What are you talking about?
I won't disagree with Hannah's statement. I'll accept it, just as you said.
Jesus, Maud, I'm not telling you to do that. You'd have to be mad. The Gardaí have nothing, nothing at all on you. And Hannah's a terrible witness. Any decent lawyer could destroy her credibility in about 30 seconds. Do you not see? You'd be handing them a chunk of the puzzle for no reason.
It's not for no reason. I've every reason. It'll get Hannah out of prison, with her baby. It'll give her a chance.
Her eyes searched his.
You said she stayed clean, all this time, in prison with drugs everywhere. If she can do that in prison, she'll do it outside, and you'll help her.
Tom brought his hands up over his eyes, pressed hard.
Fuck! Fuck, Maud! This isn't right.
He took his hands away.
What about you? Are you happy to sit in jail for 20 years?
He was asking her if she'd given up. She shook her head slowly.
Do you think Hannah's evidence is enough to convict me? If I say I bought the stuff for personal use and Mother must have seen it and taken it, who is there to contradict me?
Tom's gaze held hers.
It's such a risk, Maud. Such a monstrous risk.
A risk worth taking. Chapter 25. It took Aisling less than 5 minutes to find it, once she knew what she was looking for. She logged back into Jack's email account, fooled about with the account settings until she found the timeline button. She clicked, and a box opened up on a screen with a graphic of a globe covered with little red location markers. Aisling clicked next, then next again, and a map of the world opened up in front of her. Again, there were little red dots scattered here and there. This time, most of them were in Ireland. Almost all of Galway was covered in a large red disc, then a scattering of red dots appeared in Dublin and elsewhere. A handful more over the European cities they'd visited together, or that Jack had visited for rugby weekends, London, Edinburgh, Paris, Rome. There was a dot over northern Italy, where they'd holidayed with friends the previous summer. How much could this thing tell her? She clicked on the mass of red around Galway. The map zoomed in, and the red splodge resolved into hundreds of red dots. There were larger circles around their home, Jack's work, his gym, their local pub, places where Jack spent a lot of time. It took her another few minutes of poking about to figure out that the information could be searched by date. Feeling uneasy, she typed in the date. The last day she had seen Jack alive, 16th of March, 2013, and Jack's last day opened up before her. Not just the places he'd been, but the routes he'd taken. The red dots were now linked by thin blue lines. She could hover over a dot or line, and the app told her what time Jack left a location. A swoop of the cursor across the screen, and she could see what time he arrived at his destination. Jesus, his whole life was in this thing. Everywhere they had been together, everywhere he had been when they were apart, all recorded on some Google database in Dublin. Had he known that he was effectively carrying a personal tracking device in his pocket? Aisling looked at her own phone, at her laptop. She used a different email provider, but for all she knew, it recorded her movements in just the same way. And she'd probably agreed to it, clicking to accept every time there was a terms update, never ever reading the fine print. It was messed up, but she was grateful for it. Someday, when she was ready, she could sit down and go through the timeline. It was a record of Jack's life, or at least some of it. And it seemed right that there should be at least this trace of him left behind. For now, though, she needed to put grief aside and think. Jack's last day. She knew as soon as she saw the timeline that Jack had not been meeting anyone. According to Google, Jack and his phone had left the house just after 10 o'clock, not long after she'd fallen asleep. He'd driven to Salt Hill, where he parked outside a deli they liked, then drove on exactly 17 minutes later. He drove out of Galway, past Headford, 1 hour and 20 minutes north, in fact, to Castlebar, then north again to Lochmask, which was where Jack went when he needed to think. There were hiking trails that snaked through forest and mountainside, tough hikes and technical climbs. If Jack had something on his mind, that was where he went to work it out, and almost always alone. He'd brought Aisling once, but it was challenging terrain, and after that they'd chosen easier, shorter hikes when they went together. If Jack had been meeting someone, they would have met in Galway in a coffee shop, or Jack would have brought them home. No. Jack had gone to Lochmask to think about the pregnancy. He'd gone there because he was upset and worried, and he needed to think. The possibility of suicide suggested itself again, and Aisling shoved it away. She looked instead at timeline. Jack had arrived at the trailhead at noon. He'd started the hike, but the record of his movements cut off 20 minutes later on the trail. Aisling sat up straighter, stared at the screen. Clicked again, but nothing changed. Jack's trace ended at Lochmask, right on the quarry trail. That was weird. Either his battery had died, or Jack had turned his phone off. The latter didn't seem likely. She'd never known him to do it. Even in the cinema, he just muted the thing. And Jack plugged his phone in every night. It should have been fully charged when he set off that morning. Aisling stared at the screen for another moment, then pushed it away. She sat back on the couch again, took a drink.
Did it matter?
He hadn't gone to Loch Mask to meet anyone, that was the point. Aisling put down her glass and walked quickly around the room. Then she leaned two hands in her forehead against the mantelpiece and rested for a long moment. This was head-wrecking. Who did she think she was fooling? She was not an investigator. She looked back at the table, at Maud's laptop, her photographs, her boarding card, her notes about Jack's death. What did it all add up to in the end? Aisling resisted an urge to lift one side of the coffee table with her foot. For a second, she could almost see the whole thing tipping, the computer and documents sliding to the floor, the wine bottle toppling and spilling. If she did it, she would leave the lot there. There was something else she had to do before she could go to bed, something she was dreading. Aisling sat again, picked up her phone. She stared at the number for a long time, thinking it all through, before she dialed. Aggie's voice was hushed, but not sleepy.
Aisling, are you all right? Hold on.
A muffled sound as Aggie left what was probably her bedroom and closed the door behind her.
Sorry, dear, Brendan's sleeping. Are you all right?
I'm sorry to call you so late, Aggie. I'm fine. Just... Maud won't be able to visit this weekend. Silence for a moment.
Oh.
Aisling took a breath. She's been arrested. The guards think she killed her mother. Back in 93. Aisling closed her eyes as she listened to Aggie breathe out. A sudden shocked exhalation.
Oh God. This wasn't the way to tell her.
She could almost see the color drain from Aggie's face. The other end of the phone was quiet. Aggie? Aggie, are you all right?
That poor girl, Aggie said. That poor, poor girl.
There was deep pity in Aggie's voice, but no surprise.
Aggie, you knew, didn't you?
Aggie didn't speak for a long time, so long that it began to seem like she wouldn't speak again.
Tell me,
Aisling said gently. Aggie's voice sounded like it was coming from a long way away.
We couldn't have children of our own, me and Brendan. We never knew why, just the way it was. We fostered children instead. So many children. Some of them we had for just a few days, a weekend maybe. Some for months and months. And some came back again and again.
Aisling heard the creaking of a door opening and closing. She imagined Aggie going to the kitchen, finding her chair near the warmth of the aga, seeking comfort.
Some of those children had been through hell by the time they got to us, Aisling. And eventually, every time, we sent them back to it. You'll never know what that was like. To hold a child in your arms, to soothe his pain, to heal his injuries, to show him what love is, maybe for the first time in his little life. Only to have him taken away, then sent back to what brought him to you in the first place.
But you kept going, Aisling said.
Brendan wanted to stop. It was breaking my heart. It was breaking both of us. But all I could think was that there'd be a child somewhere in some terrible place and a social worker deciding that she'd have to leave him there because there was nowhere better to go. We did stop for a while, but I had such nightmares.
Her voice was drifting away, getting lost in the memories. What happened with Jack?
There was a boy before Jack. His name was Tom. Such a lovely boy. He came to us for a few months when his mother was admitted to hospital. But before us, he had been to other places. I found him one day in the bathroom, scrubbing himself raw. He didn't tell me what happened. Not then, anyway.
Aisling waited.
2 years later, Tom came to our door. He was back with his family. Things were going better for them. Tom told me that there was a little boy in danger. That what had happened to Tom would happen to this child, unless I was willing to step in and take him.
Jack?
Yes, that was Jack. I said I would do whatever I could. Press Tom to give me names, let me call the guards, call in the social workers straight away. But Tom wouldn't say anything more. He told me I needed to wait 2 more days and he would be back. And he did come back. 2 mornings later, he showed up at the back door and told me that Jack was at the hospital, that he needed me.
Tom came to you before Hilaria died?
Yes. Aisling turned it all over in her head. This meant Maud was guilty. She'd known her mother was going to die, known that Jack would need a home, had worked with Tom to make sure he had one. Christ almighty, it was so cold, so planned. What sort of person could do that?
You never told anyone, Aisling said.
It was weeks before I figured it out. I didn't know about the heroin, not in the beginning. By the time I realized what must have happened, I had Jack. I was afraid I would lose him.
Aisling made reassuring noises, but the truth was that she didn't understand. None of this made sense to her. It was like she had strayed into a nightmare, where no one and nothing was as it seemed. Jack, lovely Jack, dead by suicide or murdered because of some secret life he had never shared with her. And Aggie, lovely, motherly Aggie, hiding secrets of her own.
She must have pulled every string she had to get Jack fostered with her, to adopt him.
Aggie was still talking.
When Jack was 7, we applied to adopt him. We didn't change his surname, though. He was a Blake, and he stayed a Blake. That was for Maud, in case she ever came back.
Aisling got off the phone as quickly as she could, promised Aggie whatever she wanted to hear. She didn't want to talk to her, didn't want to hear her talking about Maud the murderer, with that note of what in her voice? Empathy? Gratitude? As soon as she hung up, she started to gather everything up, to repack Maud's backpack, to shut her own computer down. It was Friday night. She would go to work the next day after all. She'd been scheduled for an early shift. She would do that, then do the handover with Cummins on Sunday evening, since that was all arranged. Then take some time off. Try to get her head straight. On Monday, she would go to the police, bring them Maud's boarding card and her laptop, and ask them if they would review Jack's call and message history. This was, it had always been, a matter for the Gardaí, and she had other things to worry about. She was finished playing detective. When the room was tidy, she found Jack's jumper where she had left it on the back of the couch and pulled it on. She sat and thought about the future she was fighting to hold on to. A future that suddenly seemed leached of color, of warmth, of humanity. It was the story of her life. She strove for perfection, and the closer she got, the emptier she felt. Aisling had never felt more alone, less worthy, than she did in that moment. She laid her aching, tired head down on the arm of the couch, curled into a ball, and cried. Saturday, 30th of March, 2013. Chapter 26.
I've lost control of the thing completely, Cormac said.
He was lying in bed, his arms folded behind his head on the pillow, so he could watch Emma as she moved around the room. She was wrapped in a towel, her hair still wet from the shower.
And she's been arrested, this woman?
Cormac nodded. Emma took a pair of knickers from her underwear drawer and pulled them on under her towel. She dropped the towel to put on a bra, then pulled a grey t-shirt over her head. It was old and well-loved, and had moulded itself to her soft curves in a way that made him want to pull her down into the bed beside him and restart what they had just finished. She flipped her hair forwards and wrapped her towel around it, twisting it so that it formed a neat turban, then came and sat down on the bed facing him, tucking her bare legs back under the covers.
Do you think she did it? I don't know.
Her grey eyes were assessing.
I think you do know, Corm.
He grimaced, closed his eyes.
She may have. Her mother was abusive. Maud loved her little brother. She could have done it to protect him. But the abuse had been going on for years, and the mother was on her way out. According to the post-mortem, she didn't have more than a few months, maybe 6 at the outside. End-stage liver disease. Maud would have known. So why do it then? Why take the risk? I can't see it.
Emma had pushed her feet up against his thigh. They were cold, and he reached down to rub some warmth into them.
Maybe she didn't know, didn't realize. She was very young, after all. And I'm not sure I would recognize end-stage liver disease. So, a teenager? Used to her mother being sick?
Emma shrugged. Maybe she'd had enough, just lost it after years of abuse. Isn't that what happens sometimes?
Cormac was shaking his head slowly.
She was 15 years old. She would have had to secure heroin, needle, everything. Then learn how to inject it, all of which would have taken planning, premeditation. This wasn't a situation where someone finally lost it and retaliated.
And Danny thinks he knows where she got the heroin.
Cormac couldn't prevent his face from stiffening, and Emma, watching him, said,
Do you really think he would do that? Solicit someone to give false evidence, I mean.
Jesus, I dunno, I'm beginning to think I don't know Danny at all.
And everything about this case has been off from the beginning. The fact that this investigation was prioritized when there was nothing new to go on at the time. There wasn't a cop in the station who didn't know the case was intended to put pressure on Maud Blake to get her off our backs about her brother's suicide. Which makes no sense. And then suddenly, Danny's up to his knees in my case, bringing me a junkie mother's statement, and Murphy's singing his praises like he just caught Osama bin Laden.
Cormac snorted.
I suppose it's just as well we never met them for dinner then, Emma said, and curled her toes around his leg, smiling slightly, probably trying to cheer him up.
He forced a smile in return, and she abandoned her spot at the end of the bed, climbing back under the covers and laying her head on his chest. She took one of his hands in hers, slid her fingers through his and squeezed, as if engaging in a gentle game of mercy.
What's in it for him, though? She asked.
Maybe he thinks he'll get another promotion if he keeps the boss happy.
Well, then what's in it for the boss? What does it matter if she asks questions about her brother's suicide? I don't understand why that's a big deal.
Cormac was beginning to think it was a very big deal.
Something was going on here. Something much bigger than Garda embarrassment over a shoddy investigation.
He just couldn't see the connection. Not yet.
Danny's sister is missing. She's been gone for 2 weeks, and they've only just started searching for her.
What? Why? I mean, why the delay?
He shook his head.
Her aunt reported her missing. Her parents said no, that she was probably with friends.
What does Danny say?
He thought it was nothing initially. He's realized now, I think, that there really is a problem, I think. I haven't spoken to him since Thursday. I tried to call yesterday, last night, but no answer.
Emma was quiet for a moment.
Do you regret coming back?
She asked softly. He squeezed her hand, then brought it to his lips in a quick kiss.
Same bullshit, different location, he said, his tone lighter.
They were both quiet, listening to the rain outside. It was early Saturday morning. Cormac wasn't sure if there was much point in going into the station with Murphy in Dublin until Tuesday and the case effectively out of his hands. He'd spend the day with Emma, think about how to handle Murphy when he saw him. How could he respond to that rumour if that was the root of the trouble?
Pull a Maud on it? And look for CCTV footage from the hotel? A hotel like the Radisson might have cameras in the hallways, would certainly have them in the lobby. He'd need to send someone else to get it, though. Once he put his hands on that evidence, it would be tainted.
Christ, if Murphy was taking the rumor seriously, things could get messy very quickly.
He'd have to get out in front. He needed his job, needed to be in Galway.
Mostly because this was where Emma would be for at least the next couple of years, but partly because he'd never failed at anything, and he didn't want to start here.
Cormac tried to put the job out of his mind. He'd sent Fisher for the security footage when he came in from Strand Hill, get him to log it into evidence. Beyond that, there was no point in obsessing about the station all weekend. If the weather improved, Emma would want to go for a walk on the prom, which would be freezing but packed with people taking their morning stroll to the crash of the grey Atlantic waves. They'd get lunch somewhere warm and busy, and come home afterwards with the newspapers to sit in front of the fire for the rest of the day.
Cormac kissed Emma, then pushed himself out of bed and headed for the shower, moving like an old man. He knew he had what he wanted, that he should be happy. But at best, he'd just screwed up his first case in a new job, and at worst, half the Galway police force was corrupt as fuck. Chapter 27. Tom left Galway at 7 a.m. on Saturday morning and got to the Mountjoy security gate by 10. Visiting hours were 10 to 12, and he'd had a booking before the Maud situation had blown up, before he'd known about Hannah's statement. Hannah was being held at the Docus Centre, a special-purpose block built within the confines of Mountjoy Prison. The Docus Centre was operating at 140% capacity. Rooms intended for single occupants had been fitted out with pairs of bunk beds and were occupied by up to 5. 30% of the inmates were on methadone replacement. It was medium security, but some of the inmates should have been in solitary. It was not the place for a child. Hannah was already waiting for him, seated at a table with Saoirse asleep in her arms. The room was like a particularly soulless university canteen without the buffet, furnished with formica tables and plastic chairs. It filled up slowly, families taking their places around tables. A little girl with an anxious expression on her face was drawn into a hug where she started to cry. Tom looked away. Visits were only half an hour, a pitiful period of time for children to catch up with a mother they got to see only once a week. Hannah sat at a table pushed up against the far wall, alone if you didn't count the baby on her lap. She looked tired and strained, pale-faced with grey circles under her eyes. Her dark hair was unwashed and tied back from her face in the same loose plait she'd worn at 15. Despite everything, she was still beautiful. Hannah acknowledged him with a brief flick of her eyes and an attempt at a smile before she dropped her gaze again to her daughter. Tom looked at his sleeping niece. She was a round, happy little baby. He desperately wanted her to stay that way. "I already know the appeal was refused," Hannah said, her head still bowed. "How do you?" "Cellmate has a cousin who's a social worker. She was delighted to give me the good news."
"Bitch. When did she tell you?"
"Week ago."
Jesus.
He'd wanted to keep it from her, hoping that he'd find a solution. He'd known the likely outcome when he'd visited the week before, but he'd had to tell her about Jack, and that seemed enough tragedy for one day. Besides, he'd still been hoping to pull a rabbit out of the hat. I'd even thought about asking Aggie. But she was too old to foster now. She couldn't be the rescuer this time. And even if he'd had a guardian angel to call on, these days the system was much more regulated.
"I tried, Hannah. But I'm not married. I work long hours. I told them I'd hire a full-time nanny, but they insisted they want a foster parent who'll be at home all day."
"Bastards," she said. But she was distracted, her tone without rancor. She stroked a stray lock of wispy hair back from Saoirse's forehead. She hadn't met his eyes once since he sat down.
"How is she?"
he asked. "She's grand. She doesn't know where she is. She doesn't know what normal is." Tom said nothing. They'd talked so many times about the situation she was in, the overcrowding, the drugs, her fears for Saoirse. Hannah was terrified for her baby. He'd tried and tried to reassure her. When his first application to foster the baby had been refused, he'd told her that the system was better now, that the families were properly vetted, that he'd visit Saoirse every week, as much as they'd let him. She looked at him with despairing blue eyes and said, "You won't be there at night, though, will you, Tom? You won't be there when they come into her room at night?"
"Hannah,"
Tom said quietly. She still wouldn't look at him.
"Ann, I know."
"What do you know?"
"I spoke to Maud."
She went absolutely still. The remaining colour deserted her face, and for a moment he thought she was going to faint. She cradled the baby closer, raised her eyes to his. "Have they arrested her?" He nodded, and her eyes filled with tears. "Tom, I feel like there's nothing left of me. I keep trying. I keep saying I'll do anything at all to keep Saoirse safe. And every time I take another step, everything gets worse. I'm running out of choices, and every choice I make is a bad one."
"Listen to me, Hannah. You're doing the best you can."
Do you remember when we were kids, Tom? Do you remember how we used to be together? You and Maud so serious. And the way she would mind little Jack. Do you remember when she came to Kilmore first? She used to push him around everywhere in that knackered old pram. And the way she'd run, I mean just run home after school. And when he got bigger, she never left him alone, except at school.
I remember, said Tom.
He waited, but she said nothing, her eyes lost in memories.
Hannah, tell me the whole story. How did you know Maud was home? Who did you call to set this up?
Her eyes came to his, confused. I didn't know, she said, and I didn't tell anyone. He came to me.
Who?
The guard. He said he knew I grew up in Kilmore, that I had a drug history. He said he could get me early release if I gave evidence against a woman from back in the day. I didn't know he was talking about Maud, not at first.
Tom sat still. You didn't call anyone? Didn't mention Maud by name to anyone?
No, Hannah said. Not to a sinner. Why would I? Maud's been gone 20 years, or at least I thought she was. Why would I think the Shades would give a shit about something that happened 20 years ago?
Tell me exactly what he said.
Hannah shook her head. They brought me out of my cell to an interview room. This guy, McIntyre, is his name. He was waiting for me. He took Saoirse out of my arms the moment I came into the room. He held her, gave her a cuddle, and I just knew Tom. He would have knocked her against the wall as soon as look at her. Holding her was a threat, you know? Her grip on the baby had tightened as she spoke. Her voice grew louder, and Saoirse shifted and made a soft sound in her sleep. Tom reached across and held Hannah's hand, and she loosened her grip. After Saoirse was born and I knew I couldn't lose her, I went to the governor. Told him I would give evidence to the Gardaí if it would get me a remittance on my sentence. He set me up with a detective. I told her everything I knew about the trade, gave her names. Stuff that would get me killed properly if anyone was to know about it. But she told me my information was no good to them, that they knew it all already. That the people I knew were too low level to be any use to them.
You never told me,
Tom said. I was ashamed of myself, Hannah said. The people I talked about, they were the dregs mostly, but I still felt like the worst kind of shit.
And McIntyre?
I don't know. He must have gotten my name from somewhere. He knew enough to look me up anyway, check my record. I was still living at home in Kilmore the first time I was picked up by the police. He said they were very interested in someone called Maud Blake, and if I was in a position to say I knew Maud had bought or tried to buy heroin back in 1993, that he could get my sentence remitted.
Christ.
Tom held Hannah's gaze, wondered for a moment if she could be shading the truth, but the look she gave him was open and clear, and Hannah had always been a useless liar.
He didn't know. He still doesn't know.
Hannah shook her head slowly. I told him I would go along with it. Told him I'd say that I knew Maud, that I knew she had been looking for someone who sold heroin. But that's it. She locked eyes with him then, pleading with him to understand. And he had the strongest moment of déjà vu, back to the morning when he and Maud had found Hannah at the apartment. The morning when they'd sat with her and explained everything, and she'd made no protest, asked no questions, just got them what they needed, and explained exactly what to do. He remembered the sick feeling in his stomach as he realized just how familiar she was with the process. Remembered the moment before he and Maud had left, how the three of them had sat there in silent solidarity. Three damaged kids, determined to save a fourth.
This was a setup,
Tom said.
Maud was right. They are trying to set her up. This isn't about Ilaria. They're after her because of Jack.
What? Hannah asked.
And did McIntyre realize that he'd stumbled onto the truth?
No, I didn't tell him. I wouldn't have gone along with it at all, except he told me that if I didn't give him the statement, he could charge me with conspiracy to commit murder. He would say that I was in on it. Either way, Maud was going down, and I could go down with her. But if I gave the statement, he'd get my sentence remitted and me out of here before the end of the month. That I'd get to keep Saoirse.
Why didn't you call me?
He told me I had to make a decision there and then. If I agreed, he would take a statement from me. Then he'd get a deal signed off.
Tom hesitated. Did you get the deal in writing?
She snorted.
Of course I bloody did. You can't spend a year in this place and learn nothing. You're going to ask me to withdraw it.
But the thing is, Tom, apart from Saoirse, this guy McIntyre, I'm afraid of him. He's a Garda, but I think he's the type who'd kill you if you crossed him.
Hannah had good instincts for everyone but her boyfriends. No, Han, no. I'm not going to ask you to withdraw it. Jesus, I'm your brother. And it's not just me. Maud wants you to stand over your statement. She's not going to contradict you. She wants you and the baby out.
She held his gaze, fear and hope in her eyes.
What? I don't understand.
She thinks she can beat the case regardless of your statement. She's willing to take the risk because she owes you.
Jesus.
A breath of hope, of air, an exhalation.
I think she should be right. There's not enough evidence against her for a murder case, nowhere near enough. But I'm worried.
Tell me, she said, and her eyes were dry now and steady.
I'm worried. This guy, McIntyre, is out to get her. Maybe more Gardaí, too. Why? This all has to come back to Jack, doesn't it? Someone killed Jack, and Maud wouldn't let it go. So now they're after her, too.
And if they were willing to kill Jack?
She let her voice trail off.
Tell me what you want me to do.
He shook his head. Let's get you out first, then figure out what to do next. Maud's bail hearing is on Monday. The full trial won't be for months. What does your deal say? When do you get out?
She pulled a folded sheet of paper from her pocket, handed it across to him, and he read.
Jesus, he said. We might be able to get you out after the bail hearing, the way this thing is written, and with Saoirse and everything.
Really? On Monday? That can't be. He never said.
He'd want you here as long as possible, to keep an eye on you. But the deal is done. Remittance of sentence in exchange for testimony. You've given a written statement. I'll bring this to the governor. See if I can arrange release for Monday.
She reached across the table and gripped his hand hard, tears brimming in her eyes. She couldn't speak. She swallowed.
Do what you can, Tom, she said. And tell Maud thank you. Tell her I'll see her soon.
Chapter 28. They went out on Saturday night. It was the last thing Cormac wanted to do, but Emma pulled a rare veto. If they sat in and watched TV, he would only brood over everything and end up in worse humor than he'd started. Better to go out, have a few drinks, talk to friends about everything and anything else for a while. Let his subconscious mind work at the problem while the rest of him got on with living. She knew him well, and she might have been right if it wasn't for the fact that most of his friends were in Dublin, and none of them were here in the pub, providing the required distraction. Instead, they had met most of Emma's team. Emma's second-in-command had young children and hadn't come. The others, three women and two men, all under 30, were happy with their new jobs, happy with the progress of the last few weeks, and ready to celebrate both. In other circumstances, he might have enjoyed their company, but tonight they seemed too young, and in spite of their undoubtedly vast intellects, too insubstantial. Cormac could feel Emma's eyes on him as he allowed himself to withdraw from the conversation. He gave her a wink and was relieved when the buzzing phone in his pocket gave him a reason to excuse himself and go outside. It was Fisher, calling from Strand Hill.
Anything?
Cormac asked.
I've been watching him since 4,
Fisher said. Cormac checked his watch. 9 o'clock. Fisher continued.
It's busy. Other than himself, there's just a young one working the bar. A student, I'd say. When she arrived, Lanigan disappeared into the back for a while. He might have eaten, but if he did, there's no opportunity in it for us. Since then, he's been working. He's not touching the drink. Just a plastic bottle of water he keeps behind the bar. He's taken a few swigs out of that, but I don't see how we could reach it.
And?
Cormac asked.
Fisher's tone told him there was something else.
I think he's a smoker. He served me himself, and his fingers are stained. Every 30 minutes or so he's disappearing out the back. Has to be to have a smoke. Can't be inside. Smoking ban.
Cormac thought for a moment.
Can you get around back without being seen? It's a car park. It's full, and mine's out on the street. I could wait for the next person to go, take their place and wait and see.
It was a mark of Fisher's ambition, or maybe his youth, that he sounded enthusiastic at the prospect.
Do that, Cormac said. Text me when you have something.
When he returned to the bar, a full pint stood next to his last one, which he hadn't finished. There was talk of going on to a nightclub. Cormac caught Emma's eye. Not a fucking chance. She smiled, a quick flash of amusement, noticed by no one but him. God, he loved that smile. That sudden dimple in her cheek, the arch of her eyebrow. He felt his mood lighten and took a drink from his pint. Then he turned to his neighbor and joined a debate about Galway football. They walked home together, hand in hand. It was cold, but the rain held off, and there was such simple pleasure in that.
What will you do?
She asked. He shook his head.
I don't know. If Murphy ordered that arrest, then he's taken the case out of my hands. If he didn't order it, if Mel Hackett just saw an opportunity and went for it, that might be just as bad.
Why? Because Murphy won't undo it?
Exactly. She must have thought, they must have thought, that Murphy would at least condone it.
He shook his head. He had bigger problems, but he wasn't telling Emma about the rumor, not until he had dealt with it and it was in the rear-view mirror. He couldn't wrap his head around how quickly things had gone wrong, how fast the ground had slipped from under his feet. The first few weeks had been nothing more than he'd expected, a testing period. He hadn't thought much of the hazing. Messing around with cold case files was unprofessional, in his opinion, but it had been within the realm of normal. But the looks, the not-so-subtle cold shoulders he'd received from other detectives this week, was something different. It was the rumor of his involvement with Maud Blake that was doing the damage. And if Murphy suspected him of that, then taking him off the case was the necessary next step. It could be Healy. Healy saw him as a threat to whatever he had going on, and perhaps he had decided he was going to take Cormac down before Cormac could get to him. But Cormac had a nagging feeling that Danny was in this thing too. As they turned into Canal Walk, his phone buzzed in his pocket. A text from Fisher.
He smokes at the back door, drops his butts, probably 100 of them there. Take some?
What is it? Emma asked. Cormac replied,
leave it. Find a place to stay. I'll meet you tomorrow, 4 o'clock. Bring some rubbish bags and a brush. I might have to work tomorrow,
he said to Emma. Her eyes searched his face in the dim light of the street lamp. Another case? At his nod, she shrugged. If you have to, you have to. She didn't ask him any more about the Blake case, about what he was going to do on Monday. She must have known that he didn't have any answers. Instead, they went home, went to bed, and did what they could to forget about everything but each other. Sunday, 31st of March, 2013. Chapter 29. Despite all her resolution, by mid-morning on Sunday, Aisling found herself driving out to Loch Mask, Jack's smaller backpack keeping her company on the passenger seat. She'd traced his every step so far, including the deli shop, and the backpack held a sandwich and a thermos of soup, as well as the mini first aid kit, her water, and the basics that usually took up space at the bottom of the bag. She reached the trail at 2 hours later than Jack would have. The small parking area was just off the road, but hidden by trees. If you didn't know it, it would have been easy to pass it by. The place was deserted, despite the fact that the weather was good for the time of year. No rain, beyond the odd drizzle, and the sun had won the battle with the clouds so far that day. Aisling parked and grabbed the backpack and her jacket. She pulled everything on as she stood beside the car. Would she really find answers here? What was she looking for? Signs of a struggle? She felt ridiculous, a grown-up playing at Veronica Mars. She excused it by telling herself that this was where Jack came to figure things out. Maybe it would work for her. She zipped up her jacket and started to walk. The advantage of the cold weather was, of course, that the mud was frozen. She was able to balance her way through the worst of the tussocks and ruts that made up the first few hundred meters of the track. Once she'd passed the last farm gate, the track narrowed very quickly, and the trees drew in overhead, splintering and fracturing the feeble winter sunlight. The track split in two and she chose the right fork. The left would have been an easier route, out towards the quarry, but she wasn't looking for easy that day, and in any case, timeline told her that Jack had taken the route up the mountain. She reached the point where Jack's trail stopped and looked about her. It was shaded under the canopy, the air frigid, the ground covered in a blanket of wet leaves. There was nothing to see. She turned, stared back down the trail, then turned again. Nothing. The place was innocent and deserted, and there was no sign that Jack had ever been here. Aisling told herself she hadn't been expecting anything anyway, and pressed on. She pushed hard, and it didn't take long for her breath to feel tight in her chest, for her hamstrings to complain. She ignored it and pushed harder. She wanted to be out from underneath the canopy, wanted the warmth of the sun on her face. When she was out, she would slow her pace, would need to anyway once she hit the steeper incline. The hike was harder than she remembered, and she wasn't as fit as she should be, but she was strong enough. She stopped thinking about everything, about Jack, about the future, switched everything off except her focus on the next step, the next breath. Aisling stopped to eat 2 hours into the hike. She hadn't made it to the halfway point, but her breath was coming in hard gasps, and she was high enough that she had a view out over the quarry. She found a place, a little protected from the buffeting wind by a scrubby tree, and sat. The cold settled about her like a cloak, chilling the sweat on her brow and stiffening her hands. The sun was still out, but it was a winter sun, all show and no substance, and clouds were gathering. She was grateful for the warmth of the soup in her thermos as she ate and took in the view. The water below was ice-cold perfection, reflecting the sky overhead. When they had come in summer, the water had looked so inviting that she'd suggested a detour and a swim, but Jack had told her that what she was admiring was a flooded quarry, and the water was toxic.
"If you were closer, you'd be able to see," he'd said. "There are warning signs all around it, because people did come here to swim. There are fences, too. There's a farm down there, and the fences keep the livestock from drinking the water."
He made a face.
"You'd never think it was toxic. Up close, the water is bright blue and incredibly clear. Clear enough to see the car wrecks and mattresses that have been dumped in it."
He grinned at her.
"Still, looks great from here, though, doesn't it?"
Now Aisling sat far above the quarry and enjoyed the illusion. She let herself relax, felt the lightening of the weight on her shoulders, the first loosening of the tension she'd carried in her muscles since Jack had died. She felt so close to him here. She smiled through eyes that were suddenly filled with tears and drank again from her thermos. All at once, Aisling was distracted by a movement from the tree line at the far side of the quarry. She squinted, leaned forward. It was a car, must be a four-wheel drive, making its bumpy way towards the quarry. Another followed a little behind. Both vehicles stopped and people got out. They walked towards the water, seemed to consult. Then two of the figures returned to the cars. Curiosity got the better of her. She pulled Jack's backpack towards her and looked through it for the mini binoculars he'd carried. He'd had two pairs, but the small set that she'd bought him for Christmas 2 years before was usually in this bag. Yes. She pulled them out and unfolded them, put them to her eyes and adjusted the focus. The figures swam into view. They were Gardaí, two in uniform, and they were unloading diving equipment from the cars. She watched as two men put on dry suits, then one of them tied a rope around his waist, and they both approached the water. The taller of them walked straight in, took a moment to adjust his mask, then started to swim. The other followed a few meters into the water and stood there, paying out the rope until there was about 20 meters between them. The swimmer gave a thumbs up, then went under. They were searching for something. The diver swam a full arc, using the rope to control his position. He resurfaced, another thumbs up, the rope was paid out again, and down he went. Aisling's sandwich was abandoned, her soup rapidly cooling. She was utterly absorbed in watching them, and might have stayed longer if the sun hadn't disappeared behind a cloud, and she'd suddenly become aware that she was shivering. Aisling checked her watch. Shit, it was almost 4:30. If she didn't hurry, she wouldn't get back to the car before dark. She took a bite from her sandwich, one last swallow of cold soup, then stowed everything and started back down the trail. What could they be searching for? They were hardly there for illegally dumped mattresses and car wrecks. So what? A body? Drugs? Whatever it was something illegal. Something serious enough to get 8 Gardaí with divers out here. What if Jack had seen something? Seen someone? What if whatever the police were searching for was what had gotten Jack killed? She stopped walking, thought about the timeline map, about where Jack's phone had stopped recording his progress. It had been below the fork in the path, hadn't it? What if someone had been at the quarry that day and Jack had seen them on the trail? She could almost see Jack greeting someone, giving a nod, a smile, a roll of the eyes that said, "Aren't we mad to be walking out here in winter?" Shit! Aisling started running. She slipped twice, landing on her arse. The third time she twisted her ankle, but she ignored the pain and kept going. She got to the fork before dark, but the sun was setting and the light was going. She cast about, but the narrow trail was floored with leaves and twigs and mud and she saw nothing. Breathing hard, she kept her head down and walked slowly ahead. She pushed at clumps of leaves with the toe of her boot. Nothing. She kept going until she was 20 meters below the fork, then she stopped and turned back again, retracing her steps. She did that twice more as the sun set until she could barely see the ground in front of her. Then she dropped to her hands and knees and started feeling her way through the leaves. Wet soaked through the knees of her jeans. The ground was hard enough that there was no mud, but her hands froze in the cold until she could barely feel anything. It was so quiet, so still. Had Jack been killed here? Was this the last place he saw? She started to shake from cold and from fear. She heard a twig break and looked up and around, her breath coming faster. An animal? A deer? She saw nothing and returned to her search. She wanted to run, wanted to get out of there, but she couldn't leave. She searched again and again, until the knees of her jeans were filthy and her hands were so cold they felt numb, like prosthetics attached to the wrist. And that was how she nearly missed it. Her right hand touched something, bumped against it under its blanket of leaves, but her hand was numb and she kept moving. Had that bump felt any different from the small stones she had picked up and discarded? She returned to where her hand had been, felt around, then again, and finally, her hand closed around something. Smooth plastic. She picked it up and, despite the dark, realized that she was holding Jack's phone. Chapter 30 Sunday afternoon saw Cormac take the coast road out to Strand Hill. McSorley's bar was very close to the water, only 3 buildings back from the beach. The place was packed, cars were parked either side of the street, and it took him some time to find a spot. When he got out of the car, he looked around, taking in the smell of salt and vinegar chips, the tang of the ocean, the waves crashing in the distance. A voice came over a loudspeaker, muffled from where Cormac stood, but he heard enough to realize that a surf competition was going on. The sun was going down. The competition would end soon, and the pub would be packed. Cormac crossed the road and walked to McSorley's, then walked around the back to the car park. Fisher was already there, parked and waiting. Cormac walked to Fisher's car, opened the passenger door, got in.
"Why not Lanigan's?"
he asked.
"A beat." "Pub was already named," Fisher said. "Guy called Tom McSorley sold it to him. Suppose Lanigan didn't see the point of making the change."
Fisher had done his research, in fairness to him.
"What do we do now?"
Fisher asked.
"How long since his last fag?"
Cormac asked. Fisher checked his watch.
"He's due one." "Then we wait,"
Cormac said.
"I want to look at him."
They were far enough back not to be noticeable, but it wasn't quite dark, and Cormac held his phone to his ear when Lanigan appeared at the back door. If Lanigan did see them, he should assume that the two men were sitting in a car in his car park because one of them was making a call. Lanigan had no reason to be suspicious, after all. No one had spoken to him about either murder in 3 decades. Timothy Lanigan lit up, leaned against the wall to the right of the back door, and smoked. He took his time, and there was nothing unusual about him. except maybe that he looked at the sky as he smoked instead of down into a mobile phone. When he was finished, he stubbed the cigarette against the wall, dropped the butt on the ground, and went back into the pub. The door swung shut behind him.
No one else comes out here.
I think it's the door to the storeroom, Fisher said. The barmaid doesn't smoke, or she didn't yesterday.
Monso, said Cormac, and bring your brush.
The ground around the back door was littered with cigarette butts. There was an old planter to the left of the door, but whatever had once grown in it had long since died, and Lanigan had been using it as a bin until it started to overflow. At some point he had stopped pretending and started dropping the butts directly on the ground.
There must have been a couple of hundred of them.
Clean it up, Cormac said. We need everything gone and the place photographed before he comes back.
He gestured for Fisher to hand over a bin bag, and when Fisher did, slowly, not yet understanding, Cormac took it from him and lifted the pot, putting it inside. Fisher caught on and started to clean up the cigarette butts that were littered all over the ground. When he'd gathered the lot, he stood and looked around.
Good enough?
He asked.
It'll do, said Cormac.
He gestured Fisher back, then using the evidence camera he'd slung around his neck, he took photographs quickly but methodically. He wasn't a crime scene photographer, but these did not need to be technically perfect. It was getting dark as they returned to the car.
Stay here, Cormac said. Make a note of what time he comes out, what time he goes back in. How many cigarettes he smokes and how long it takes him. Make a note of everything and for God's sake, do it in the dark.
Where will you be?
Fisher asked.
I'm going inside for dinner,
Cormac said, and he left Fisher to it. Cormac thought about what might have attracted Lanigan to Strand Hill as he walked around the pub to the front door. The reasons not to return to his last home were obvious. He'd basically been run out of the place. Was there something about this particular town that attracted him? Plenty of teenage girls taking surf lessons now. But what would the surf scene have been like when Lanigan came here? Had it existed at all? Maybe it was simply that the pub had come up for sale at the right time. Cormac reached the front door and pushed it open, and paused for long enough to see that the pub was a big space, contemporary, not traditional. The kind of pub that served specialty brews and focaccia.